Let's pray together. Our great God, we thank you for showing us, as clearly as we do see it now, that you are more than enough for all that we need, and that all that we could possibly desire is best found by looking to you for it and looking to you as it. We thank you for what we have seen about your splendor and your majesty and your glory and how well you are able to satisfy our deepest longings and all the issues of our hearts. And we thank you for your word, which directs us in our understanding, that we might not be misled, but might be guided to the truth and guided to your presence. And we thank you for the specific directions that your word provides us with in regard to all the challenges of living life this way. And pray now that as we look into your word, you'll teach us and instruct us that we might be people of understanding, and direct us that we might be people. This is the fourth Sunday of Missions Month. And at the beginning of Missions Month, we look together at Acts chapter 1, verse 8, and the commission that the Lord gave to his apostles to be witnesses in Jerusalem and then in Judea and in Samaria and the uttermost parts of the world. And we've been looking all this month at the idea of getting involved internationally, because we mean to be a church that is committed to getting the gospel out here in London and also out in the world. And we've been looking at ways in which we can do the international part of our work, because that's kind of church we need to be, a church that does both local work and international work. So we're getting on with our work here in London, and you know all about that, I hope, already. We mean to touch lives of children and of youth and of adults, and we're planning to do that more and more effectively all the time. And so we've committed ourselves to a building project, because that's part of the way in which we're going to be able to impact our community more effectively in the years ahead. And the work is going on behind the scenes and below the surface right now, but we hope that we'll be breaking ground next spring and building an exciting addition to our building all next year. And while we are working away here in London and we've got these plans that are local, we are getting on with our work out in the world. And as a result of these Sundays in November, I think we've got a clearer idea how we as a church and how we as individuals can contribute to that work. So we looked, for example, at our partnership with the Karanjis, who is the pastor and his wife of the church in Serbia, and we're planning on sending a couple of teams to Serbia next summer to do a children's camp and a youth camp, as God has gifted some of our church family to be able to do that. And then we looked at the work of International Justice Missions with a focus on Southeast Asia, the really good work that they're doing there, and we explored the possibilities of partnering with them in that work. And last week we saw work that we are already doing through the Reicherts, through Richard and Hope Reichert in Cuba, and can continue to do. And there is an adventure in Peru for some of the youth in our church as well, with a missions trip for the high school students planned next summer. And this morning we looked at what we can do about some of the problems in Africa. We mean to be both involved internationally and here in the city of London, because that's how God has called us, to display the glory of God. That's how we are to make known the greatness of God. That's the work we share. So all of that, if you think this through, raises a question, which I'd like us to address together this morning. Here's this morning's obvious question: how in the world are we going to pay for all of this? You as a church family have been generous to Transworld Radio, which sneaked in on the Missions Month, although it was actually a Sunday in October that they made the presentation. And you were generous again to the International Justice Mission and to the Reicherts Cuba thing that we looked at last week. And I'm sure some of you will want to get to our website and be generous in regard to that Africa project today. And meanwhile, we've got our obligations here in London. So the question is, how is a church like ours going to pay for that? And that reminds me of a little joke that was included in a card that some nice person sent to me not too long ago. She ended the nice little note she wrote by saying, "Here's a little joke for you, Pastor Mike." She had a minister stood up in front of his church family one day, and he said, "I have some wonderful news and some rather sad news. The wonderful news, the Lord has richly provided us already with all the money we need for all the work that he's given us to do. That's the wonderful news. And the rather sad news, a lot of that money is still in your own personal bank accounts." A joke, but you can see where we're going with this. How are we going to pay for all the work that God has given us to do here in London and around the world? He's very plain about it in his word. God is plain about it, and in a number of places, a number of contexts, For example, well, here's our text this morning. Let me show you how we're going to pay for all this work. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 9 and 10 is specifically our text this morning. And here's what it says in the book of wisdom, the book of Proverbs, chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. Honor the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of all your produce. Then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will be bursting with wine. How are we going to pay for all the work that God has given us to do locally and internationally? By honoring Him with our wealth and with the first fruits of all our produce. And considering that that word first fruits occurs here in the Bible, what you should understand is that this is a direct allusion to the biblical practice of the tithe, of tithing, or setting aside 10%, a tenth, that's what tithe means, a tithe of your income for the work of the Lord. This has been the practice of God's people ever since there was a group called God's people, ever since Abram was called by God to become what we now know as the father of our faith. You can read it for yourself, for example, in the life story of Abram in the book of Genesis. He comes back from a battle that went his way. He came back with a bunch of stuff that he got as the income of his military victory. He encounters a mysterious king who is also a priest. That was sort of a unique thing, this mysterious character Melchizedek. And we read in Genesis 14 that he, Melchizedek, blessed him, that's our man Abram, and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And look what happens next. Abram gave him a tenth, a tithe, of everything. And from that time on, all the way through the Bible, it is assumed that what God's people do with their money is set aside the first 10% for His work and live off the 90% as if that's all they had been given to live off. The tithe, or the tenth, is the practice of God's people according to the Bible. Now, if this is sounding kind of spooky to you, it might be for one of two reasons. If you're a visitor here just dropping in to see what's going on, and you're a little spooked out about the fact that I am fulfilling your stereotypes and cliches about what pastors do. Here I am talking about money. Just know that I hardly ever do this. That, in fact, the rule of thumb is I do this once a year, and actually I'm a little bad and often don't do it every 2 years. So you got lucky and showed up at the very Sunday when I talk about this stuff. And you can be reasonably assured that I won't talk about this for a while again. If that helps, I'm glad. If, on the other hand, you are finding this whole thing sort of strange and spooky from the insider's perspective, you've settled into the church family, and now you're just catching on to the fact that we expect, as part of the church family, that you will help us to finance all the great things we're doing all around the world, including here in London, by setting aside the first 10% of your income, if that seems to you a strange thing, I want you to know I feel your pain, and I sympathize with the reaction, because I remember so clearly myself when I first heard about this thing called tithing. It was in my first year of university. I'd become a Christian back in grade 13. That was what they used to call the last year of high school, back in the days when high schools had so many things to teach students that it took 5 years to pour it all into their heads. So I finished grade 13, and I worked a summer job for July and August, and I went off to university. You'll have to pardon me, it was University of Guelph, but I have an explanation. I wanted to be a veterinarian, and that's where we went when we wanted to be veterinarian. So I went to the University of Guelph, and I got involved with the campus organization. It was not Campus for Christ. The crowd here will have to accept my apology for that as well. But they didn't have Campus for Christ. They had the Navigators. So I joined the Navigators, which was as close as I could get, you know, to being a Western student going to Campus for Christ. And I went to a conference, and the Lord had been working in my life for the months since I'd become a Christian. And I went to that conference ready to get serious with God. And on the Saturday night of that conference, of all things, the cool guy who was the speaker for the weekend stood up and he spoke about this thing I'd never heard of before, tithing. And I was absolutely stunned. The thought that every single, you know, dollar that I earned would be divided up, 10% for the Lord's work and 90% for me, was absolutely staggering. Because I'd worked a summer job July and August, and I had made $1,600. Which, by the way, was half as much as you needed to go to university, tuition, books, and living in residence. It's $3,000 a year back in those days. And you could make that in a summer job, May, June, July, and August, but I was a high school student. I'd only worked July and August. I had half of what I needed and $100 more. My parents kicked in the $1,500 that year, didn't have to do it any other year. And there I was, you know, sitting on $1,600. And this fellow explained that the biblical thing to do with that was to set aside 10%. And while he was explaining the sorts of things I want to show you this morning from God's Word, I was starting to do the math. At least I would have if I'd known how to do it. So I got a pencil. I was a University of Guelph student. I got a pencil and a piece of paper, and I did the long division. Let's see, $10, $1,600. I worked it out, did it a couple times just to check. You know what? That adds up to $160. I started getting queasy at the thought of giving $160 of my hard-earned money to whatever I was going to give it to as my tithe. But I looked at the Word of God with this man as he was leading us in our understanding, and as I said, I'd gone to this conference with the idea of getting serious with God. I had a better idea than I had before what that meant. And by the end of that night, could you believe it? I took out a check from my wallet, and I wrote a check for $160. I was shaking as I did it. I wish there was a way of writing a check anonymously, because I didn't want anyone to know. Like, I was embarrassed at my own generosity. I was embarrassed for the organization that I was writing the check to. I thought, what will they do with a lump sum of this proportion? Like, surely they'll think it's a joke or something that anybody would give this much money all at once. It was, to me, a strange and wonderful thing. Strange because it was just so much money. And wonderful because, well, you'll see. Wonderful because it's a way of saying things that, well, that begins to change all sorts of aspects of our lives. And it's just, to me, an interesting thing to note that a few years later, I graduated from university, wasn't a veterinarian. I wasn't University of Guelph, actually. It doesn't get any better. It was Queens. But I graduated from a university, and I got a job. That was great. And I started a starting salary of $10,000, which was actually a really good starting salary in 1977. And without even, you know, batting an eyelash, I just went into that first job knowing that I would give $1,000 to the Lord's work. And I didn't even get nervous as I wrote checks. In fact, it was fun, because I'd already made the commitment and come to understand this is what God means for us to do with our money. And I was a manager of that, you know, that first $1,000. It wasn't mine, it was his, but I was given it to dish out. And it was fun to look around at aspects of God's work that I could invest in with that money that he had provided. And I understood that my obligation was to be responsible to live on the rest that was left over. So what was in the first place a kind of strange and spooky thing became, when I got used to it, a really fun part of life, believe it or not. So if this is all new to you, I just want to say I feel your pain, and hey, all this fun is still ahead of you, if that's how it seems to you. A couple of notes of explanation in terms of where I'm coming from so as to be understood and not misunderstood. Here's a couple of notes. In the first place, understand that this tenth, this tithe, is given to God, and you give it to God by paying for his work, by giving to the kingdom, and giving to the kingdom includes, listen carefully, this is my opinion, includes giving to your local church. But I am not one of those pastors, I know some, but I'm not one of those pastors who says that if you are a member of a church, your tithe, the whole 10%, belongs to your local church. I think there are people in the organization who wish I did believe that so I could say it with integrity, but I don't think that's how it works. People who believe that, pastors who teach that, usually go to Malachi, the book of Malachi, and show you where it says in God's Word, bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, and then they explain that the storehouse is the local church, so you cough it up. But I don't think the storehouse is the local church. I think the storehouse is the little supply place from which you dispense the tithe. I think it's a really good idea to stay organized by opening a separate bank account. And when you do your monthly or your weekly finances, always just take 10% and put it into what you could call your tithing account. That's your storehouse. And then you dish it out. Having said that, I don't think the local church owns your tithe. On the other hand, I think that if you're a part of a church, you ought to take its financial challenges to heart, and in a way, more to heart than you would take to heart the work of organizations that are noticed by and invested in by many other people besides you and a few people who go to your church. But when it comes to investing in the work of your own church, you're one of, what, dozens? You're one of a couple of hundred people in the whole universe who even know about your church. So what am I saying? I'm saying that I don't think, biblically speaking, you're obligated to give your whole tithe to your local church. But on the other hand, as a committed church member, I think that your church ought to see a big chunk of your tithe, and you should get organized about that. So perhaps two-thirds of your tithe goes to your church, or two-thirds of your tithe goes to your church, and some of the rest of it goes to its mission, and then you adopt some other Christian organizations and invest in them. And I just made up two-thirds right now, because that sounds generous to me. But I think that you ought to understand that this is money that God calls you to give to Him, and you, as a steward of that money, have to decide how, what that means and where that goes. That's one thing. Here's another thing. This that you give as your tithe is given as the first thing, the first fruits of all your produce. That being said, you need to sort out for yourself whether that means that you tithe before or after taxes. And that's no small deal, considering that the money that goes to taxes is a great big chunk of your gross income, right? Well, the simple thing to say would be, of course that's gross income, but computing gross income isn't all that simple, especially for people in their own business. And when you consider the amount of taxes that are imposed upon us without any say on our part, and you consider what governments, federal and provincial, do with our taxes, it might be that you work it through and say, no, actually, I don't consider the money that I get, that I don't get, that is my income before taxes, to be actually my income. I think my income is my money after taxes. And if that's what your conscience tells, allows you to say, then you could tithe on your net rather than your gross, or at least tithe after taxes, before taxes. But let me say this. If you tithe after taxes, then if you get an income tax refund in May or June, you ought to tithe on that. Because that is a special pile of money. If you get an income tax refund, that's money that the government gives to you because even they agree they should never have taken it from you in the first place. So then they give it to you. They say, oops, and they give it to you without interest, and then you tithe on that. But you've got to work out what it means to give it first, because the essence of the tithe is you don't give it at the end if it's left over. You give it at the first before you even begin to see what will be left over. It's all a part of Matthew 6:33. But seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. I want to show you why giving a 10% of your income to the Lord is a matter of seeking first His kingdom and His righteousness, and allowing Him to add to you everything that that raises questions about. So let's look at the spirit of tithing. Let's look at the spiritual meaning of tithing. I want to show you what we mean by tithing by seeing these verses we've looked at, verses 9 and 10 of Proverbs 3, and the neighborhood in which they live, the verses around them, which help us to understand the spirit in which we are told to honor the Lord with our wealth and with the first fruits of all our produce. Okay, so we're going to look at Proverbs 3, 9, and 10 in context. And we do that by backing up as far as verse 5. And Proverbs 3, 5 might be a verse that you're familiar with, because it might be a verse on a wall plaque, on a wall in your house, or on a bookmark or something. It's a very well-known verse, and it's significant that our verses 9 and 10 are so close to this verse 5, which says, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. So what do we mean by tithing? In the first place, from verse 5, we mean that we trust the Lord rather than ourselves. Tithing is a way of proving to yourself and to God that you trust Him more than you trust yourself. Here's the point. Talk is cheap. It's way, way, way too easy to say, oh yeah, I trust the Lord. But if you say that, and yet your commitment to Christ doesn't affect how you spend your time, or how you spend your energy, or how you dish up your money, then it's highly suspect whether you really trust the Lord at all. Trusting the Lord ought to have an impact on your time and your effort and your money. And tithing is the first impact that trusting the Lord should have on your money. How is it trusting the Lord to tithe? Well, it's a great example of obedience that defies our own understanding. Obedience that is counterintuitive. And counterintuitive is a fun word. You should look for opportunities to say it. It's just so fun to say, well, counterintuitive, isn't it? It goes against what we think is right. And that's why we're told in verse 5, trust the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. And then a couple of verses later, it will say, be not wise in your own eyes. Because the thing that's wise in most of our eyes is to make the best use we can of our puny little paycheck, because it's not going to be enough to go around with all the things that we want to do and that our kids wanted us to do with it and so on and so forth. So it's counterintuitive to say, this is not $100 of income. This is 10%. This is $10 to give to the work of the Lord and $90 for household expenses. Trusting the Lord enough to obey him looks like this in regard to money. And I want you to understand and get your mind around the fact that good things happen to people who decide to trust the Lord rather than trusting in their own understanding. Good things happen when you find yourself in a position where you say, boy, oh boy, this feels like it's going to be like a crazy adventure, but I think I'll just go ahead and obey God anyway. It will be a crazy adventure. A crazy adventure that you're going to find very exciting, because it's a matter of trusting the Lord, and he honors us as we trust him. We'll see more of that as we go. Okay, so now we're at verse 6. We're looking at the neighborhood in which verses 9 and 10 live. And verse 6 says, in all your ways, acknowledge him. So we could put down in the second place, in terms of what tithing means, that by tithing we mean that we acknowledge God's involvement in every area of our lives. Now let's agree that we should be acknowledging God's involvement in every area of our life, for the simple reason that he is involved in every area of our lives, right? I mean, it's only by his goodwill that we exist. We're told in the Bible very clearly that all things in the universe hold together by his powerful word. Only because he continues to keep us existing do we have a life. So then every aspect of life that we are involved in is by his doing. It's by his involvement. He is involved in every area of life. So obviously it's a good thing for us to acknowledge that. And then to manage every area of life in regard to the fact that we are totally dependent upon him for all things. So then why is tithing a way of acknowledging that he is involved in every area of our lives? Well, that has to do with what money is. And that has to do with why money is such a dominant subject in the teaching of Jesus. If you have one of those Bibles where everything that Jesus is quoted as saying is in red ink, you will notice if you go looking that a lot of the red ink has to do with money. Jesus talked a lot about money. You know why? Because money impacts every aspect of life. Because everything we do with money has an impact on every other area of life, sort of by default. I mean, every bit of money you put into your car, you cannot put into your house, and vice versa. And every bit of income you put into your money, into your car and your house, you cannot put into your vacation, which is what's so exciting about a vacation budget, right? Because everything you put in your vacation, you cannot put into home renovations or the upkeep or purchase of your car. Which is spent on one thing, you can't spend on any other thing. So everything, every decision to spend money on one thing impacts every other area of life. And to state the obvious, every dollar that you give away impacts all aspects of your life, because you don't spend it on any aspect of your own life. The money we give away, we don't spend on ourselves at all. So how we spend our money is a defining thing. Our lives are in part defined by where we spend our money. And tithing is a defining thing. It defines us as people who are going to trust God in every area of life and obey him, even though obeying him means that we're going to have less money for every area of life. Right? So tithing is a way of saying to God that you acknowledge him in all your ways, and that your vacation plans, and that your ideas about a car, and that your ideas about renovating or changing your house, and every other aspect of life is open season for the Lord to involve himself in your life, because you're going to allow your commitment to him to impact all those areas of life. It's a way of saying that, you know, he has our attention, and that we are trusting him, and we're told to do that. In all your ways, acknowledge him. It's a way of doing that. And then we get to verses 7 and 8. And verse 7 says, be not wise in your own eyes, which is kind of like lean not on your own understanding from verse 5. And then it says, fear the Lord and turn away from evil. Somehow you need to stop being wise in your own eyes in order to fear the Lord and turn away from evil. What does that mean? Well, that means that all that we're being told to do here, including honoring the Lord with our wealth, is a way of revering God. or respecting God, or fearing God intensely. The word fear means an intense sort of respect, a sort of reverence or respect that causes us to tremble before God. It's the real dread of displeasing Him. It's being afraid of displeasing or disappointing Him. We're told, be not wise in your own eyes, but fear the Lord. And the instructions we're given here show us what that sort of intense respect looks like. Fact of the matter is, everybody intensely respects something. Like everyone worships something. Everyone serves something. I wrote a little something about that on our website. It's there right now. We all worship something. And God is the one that we should worship. We all have an intense respect and an unwillingness to displease something or someone. And if we're not too wise in our own eyes, we'll see that we ourselves should not be the person that we intensely respect so much, but God should be the one that we respect. And it's only when we get to that level of understanding and act upon it that we've really begun to be wise, which is why we read later on in Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. We haven't started to be wise until we start to fear the Lord. And one way we show that we fear the Lord is by bringing our whole financial life under His, into obedience to Him, under His dominion. And it's significant that when we're told to fear the Lord, we're told to turn away from evil. That's how verse 7 reads. Because we should understand that in fact it's evil to do anything else. To not respect the Lord as the first and great object of our fear is evil. Because it's to refuse to give to God the attention and the respect that He alone deserves. And if you want to just think about something else this afternoon, think about the significance of what Paul says to Timothy along these lines when he says, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Because the love of what's lovable about money is it gives you the opportunity to be your own boss, to be your own God, to be in control of your own circumstances. And when instead you take the first chunk of your income and just give it to the Lord's work, then you're showing that it's not you yourself that you ultimately respect, but it's God that you respect. It's God that you look to look after you. So in the third place, what tithing means is that we revere God above all others, including ourselves. And those are the verses that lead up to verses 9 and 10, which we see, and we can go on beyond that to look at the neighbors on the other side, so to speak. And in a way, this is my favorite part of this study, verses 11 and 12, which we should see not as any kind of change of subject, but more of the same. The writer says, my son, do not despise the Lord's discipline, or be weary of His reproof. For the Lord reproves him whom He loves, as a father the son in whom He delights. In the fourth place, seeing our text in context, we mean by tithing that we value the discipline of the Lord in our lives. Not despising the Lord's discipline, or being weary of His reproof, but really valuing the discipline of the Lord. Now, to help you value the discipline of the Lord, I would encourage you not to think of it as Him, you know, chastising you, of Him spanking you, of Him punishing you, although something very much like that may be involved. But think about the discipline of the Lord as the training program of the Lord. Think about it as the program He is has embarked you on so that you can become what He means to shape you up to become. And what He means to shape you up to become is a disciple of Christ who bears a striking resemblance to your Master. What God means to make of you is a Christ-like human being. And that's going to take some work, isn't it? But isn't it exciting to think that God has a plan by which, you know, a discipline by which we are going to be shaped and conformed to become increasingly like Christ the longer we live? We should be really, really excited to be adopted into such a training program. Like if you're a pretty average jogger who every once in a while runs a marathon and nobody's particularly impressed, can imagine, then you would be thrilled, I'm sure you would, if you picked up the phone one day and it turned out to be Paula Radcliffe, who's the holder of the woman's world record for the marathon. And if she said, hello, lovey, would you like a little help with the marathoning? And you say, this is Paula Radcliffe, and she's going to help me with marathoning? That's incredible. So you'd say, oh, that'd be great. Yeah, great. She's, all right, lovey, I'll give you some directions, okay? What you want to do is just, you know, go out every day and run really long, really fast. And you say, okay, I'll do it, and you follow the program. If she got more detailed than that, and she told you you should do wind sprints or weight training or change your diet, I mean, wouldn't you say, this is an opportunity of a lifetime to be coached by the expert on the subject? And if you cared about, you know, if you cared about your marathoning, you'd follow the directions. Not despise her directions. Not, oh, it's Paula again, she's got more. You say, oh, this is a great privilege. So now we're being told, do not despise the discipline of the Lord. Don't get tired or weary of his reproof, because he loves you, and he disciplines those whom he loves. And by taking his instructions to heart and following them to the letter, we show that we're not despising his training, but we're loving his training. We're loving being trained by him. And he means to train us on a number of levels, so of course he means to train us financially, because our financial management affects every level of our life. And it should be a thrill to us. It should be great fun for us to apply the principles of Scripture to our own conduct and see what good things come. Because it's not just some, you know, some distant connection with some vague ideas about what might be good for us who's given us these directions. It's God himself. And the training program is a program by which he says we will become like Christ. We've seen so many spiritual, relational benefits in these meanings of tithing that we hardly need any other incentive. But in order to see the neighborhood for what it is, we should notice briefly that there are benefits promised, or at least held out in general, to those who will tithe. Let me show you three benefits from tithing that are here in the text. We'll go back to verse 6. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make straight your paths, which is to say, we benefit from tithing this way. We benefit by God's direction for our lives. And certainly the tithe, his insistence that we tithe, is one of the ways that he directs us. Because the more money you have, the more choices you have. And if you tithe, you have 10% less than you would have had if you don't tithe, which immediately curtails you in terms of what you can do. And by staying in obedience to God, you get directed. Like if you're standing, you know, at a fork in the road and there's five different ways you could go. You got five choices, but one of them is highly dishonest, and one of them is highly immoral, and you're committed to following Christ. So you've got three choices instead of five, because there's two you rule out of hand because you're committed to trusting and obeying God, right? So similarly, if you trust the Lord in your finances, there's a direction implied in that. There are things that you will not be able to do because you decided to give that money to the Lord instead. That's one of the ways he directs. And there will be other ways that you'll experience as well. But the general principle is, if you acknowledge him in all your ways, he will direct your paths. So one of the benefits is God's direction for our lives. In verse 8, we see another one. It says in verse 8 that healing to our flesh and refreshment to our bones comes to those who fear the Lord and turn away from evil. And so if our tithing shows that we fear the Lord and turn away from evil, a benefit that comes from us is, well, let's say it this way, God's blessing on our physical life. I would be one who says it's going way too far to see in this some sort of ironclad promise that if you fear the Lord and turn away from evil, you'll never get sick, you'll never get sore, you'll never have any problems. Because God does not exempt us from sick and sore, like God doesn't exempt us from getting old, weak, and dying. This is, generally speaking, the direction that our lives are going physically. But still there's this assurance that if we fear the Lord and turn away from evil, it will be health to our bodies. It will be refreshment to our bones, which I think can be taken in a general way of saying, as you involve the Lord in the aspects of your life, you can count on him to look after your life, including the physical aspects of your life. And of course, your tithing will impact the physical aspects of your life. Because there might be some kind of crazy, high-level, super-duper protein powder that you can't afford anymore because you're tithing. So you trust the Lord to look after your physical life in regard to all the implications that are involved in the fact that you have less money than you used to have to spend on such things as that. And there's one other blessing, there's one other thing that goes along the same lines. It comes out of our actual text, verse 10. And the idea that your barns will be filled and your vats will be bursting if you honor the Lord with your wealth and the first fruits of all your produce. The picture is of a farmer with a vineyard, and he plans to harvest a certain number of grapes and fill a certain number of vats with wine. And he honors the Lord with his wealth, and with the first fruits of all his produce. And what do you know? The barns are filled. And the vats are bursting because he harvested more, he produced more than he thought he was going to. And again, it would be saying way too much to say, as some people simplistically say, if you give the first 10% away, the 90% will expand to become 110%. So it's like a get-rich-quick scheme, and you'll have more and more and more money as long as you give more and more and more money. That's not necessarily true, except in general, as a general principle. But again, God does not exempt his people from financial challenges. He means for some of us to become great examples of what a Christian looks like when impoverished. So it's not necessarily true that you'll be healthy any more than it's necessarily true that you'll be wealthy. But the general principle is that as you invite the Lord into every aspect of your life, he gladly takes up a new place in that aspect of your life. So if you invite the Lord into your finances by obeying him in regard to your finances, he'll show up in your finances, and it will work out better than your finances would have worked out if you hadn't. But just to be clear, God does have a purpose for some of us becoming financially prosperous, a very specific purpose. And so one more text to consider this morning as we come to conclusion. What Paul said to the Christians in Corinth, 2 Corinthians chapter 9. These people had been very generous. There were other Christians in the first century who were very needy because of a famine that was going through a certain part of the world and the church. And these people had been generous. And Paul says this about that. God who supplies seed to the sower and bread for food will supply and multiply your seed for sowing and increase the harvest of your righteousness. You will be enriched in every way for all your generosity, which through us will produce thanksgiving to God. So the benefit is on our work, whether we are farmers with vineyards or whether we are producing some other product or working in some other way. We can look for God's blessing on our work, but know this, that if he enriches us financially, it's because he's calling us to a greater level of generosity. That's what it says. You will be enriched in every way for the purpose of generosity. And if God is abundantly blessing you with wealth, with money, it's because he means for you to be abundantly generous. He's calling you up to new levels of generosity. That's why he blesses us financially when he does. That's the principle, and that's the direction. But know this, that to the degree that we as a church family get this right and act upon this, to that degree, the work of the Lord that he's given us to do will be paid for. The fact of the matter is the tithe of any particular church, West London Alliance Church, for example, is a whack of money. And I would be guessing to tell you with any kind of clarity what the tithing power of this church is, but I mean, think about what the guests would get you. Guess how many families there are in the church. You can use the church directory or the church parking lot or something to take a guess at that. Guess what the average income is for your average West Londoner, and do the math, even if you need a pencil and a piece of paper. And then compute 10%. It's a lot of money. I'll tell you this, whatever the guess is that's right, the tithe of West London Alliance Church is way more than the annual budget West London Alliance Church. And we would have more money than we are budgeting to spend this year if all of us who call West London Alliance Church our church home were tithing, and a big piece of that tithe was going to West London Alliance Church. The work that the Lord has given us to do will get paid for, and this is God's way of paying for. And it's fun to be part of that. It's exciting to see how God looks after us when we use our money this way. And here's another guess, which is, you know, speculation on my part. And maybe you'll think I'm right. But I'm guessing that no one ever has, and no one ever will, get to heaven, look back on all the money that he or she gave to the Lord's work, and regret being so generous. No one's going to say, oh, there was that time I gave $160. Don't be me. The money that we give to the Lord is well invested. And the Lord is in the business of encouraging our obedience. So no one is ever going to get to heaven and regret that they were as generous, that they were as obedient as they were. And as we are generous, because we are obedient, we will find ourselves more than able to do all the exciting work that God has given us to do in London and around the world. So let's get on with that.